Hello, I'm John Dennis. It's Tuesday, the 23rd of June. Today, a new speaker for the House of Commons. But what does it mean for efforts to reform Parliament?
John Bercow is 46. He's been Conservative MP for Buckingham since 1997, and he's got a bit of a background.
Also today, Nedda, one of the protesters killed in clashes in Tehran, becomes a martyr for the opposition as the Iranian authorities continue their brutal crackdown.
It shocked me very, very much, and I was sure at that time everyone in the world, if he or she see this movie, will be shocked.
And English Heritage warns that one in seven conservation areas in England is at risk of neglect or decay.
All the greenery's gone, the hedges have gone, front gardens have gone, and the place starts getting a very difficult, different and slightly unsympathetic character.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
First, Bill Overton's got the headlines.
At least six people have been killed after two underground trains crashed in the US capital, Washington. At the peak of rush hour, one subway train was waiting outside a station when another smashed into the back of it. The end carriage of the stationary train rose up and landed on the one behind. More than 70 people were injured and rescue work will go on all day. The UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon's called for an end to arrests and the use of violence against civilians in Iran. He urged the authorities to respect civil rights, including freedom of assembly and expression. Another rally protesting against the presidential result took place in Tehran yesterday, while the Iranian Revolutionary Guards threatened a decisive confrontation with demonstrators if protests continue. In a concerted action, European countries summoned Iranian diplomats to warn against continuing the violent treatment of protesters. The House of Commons has elected the Conservative MP for Buckingham, John Bercow, as the new Speaker. It was the first ever secret ballot, and 46-year-old Mr Bercow defeated another Tory, Sir George Young, in the final runoff. He was not the most popular candidate among his own party, as his politics have been moving toward Labour, and it's believed Labour MPs carried the vote in his favour. He says he wants to implement reform of the MP's expenses system. The morning papers have plenty of reaction to the appointment. As the new Speaker takes the chair today, The Telegraph claims he flipped his second home from his constituency to his London flat and says he's agreed to pay £6,500 in capital gains tax. The Mail says he's a Tory hated by his party, tainted by expenses for Rory, and already facing a plot to unseat him. So much for a fresh start. The Times says the Tories put victorious Speaker on probation because the party had largely refused to vote for him. But it's the face of a dead Iranian student that looks out of most front pages. I am Nader, the tragic face of Iran, says the Times caption. The Financial Times calls her the student who became Iran's angel of freedom. The Independent explains when a sniper shot her dead on Saturday morning, the uprising got its martyr. Mobile phones flashed gory images of her death around the world. And The Guardian simply names her the accidental martyr. There's more news and sport throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
Amid claims and counterclaims of plots, MPs have elected a new Commons Speaker to replace Michael Martin. It's the Tory John Bercow. Will Woodward, our head of politics.
John Bercow is 46. He's been Conservative MP for Buckingham since 1997. He's married to a Labour activist who was once a Tory, Sally Ilman, a few years younger than him. And he's got a bit of a background. He was on the very far right of the Conservative Party, was in the Monday Club, and he was chairman of the Federation of Conservative Students around the time they were running Hang Mandela campaigns. And since those youthful indiscretions, quite big indiscretions, he's been moving steadily leftwards. He was a centrist Tory, then very much on the left of the Tory party. And one of those people who every time there's talk of another defector from the Tories to Labour, Bercow's name has been in the frame. So he's got some form.
So how did a relative unknown win against such strong opposition of big names?
He's pitched himself as a clean break with the past, and he's promising all kinds of changes. But in some ways, this was a victory for a kind of machine. He has been wooing Labour MPs for years now. He made it clear quite a while ago that he wanted to be Speaker, and he's worked them very hard. And I think he's managed to persuade enough on the Labour benches where the majority of his support came in the final runoff, to back him. It was a sort of fairly open field. I did feel if somebody had been particularly dynamic in the run-up to the contest yesterday, they might have come through. But there was nobody of sufficiently high stature who was able to sort of overturn the Berko bandwagon.
Well, the reception was quite strange in Parliament when he was announced. All the clapping came from the Labour side. And some Tories are saying that they'll vote him out again if they win the next election. I mean, that's not a very good start, is it?
No, I mean, it's a curious thing, and there's a lot of talk at the moment about making Parliament clearer and making it connect with the public more. And I think some people will be a bit mystified as to why the Conservatives are so unhappy that they've got a Conservative as Speaker after two Labour MPs. But they are worried, and I think, in a way, there's a sense of him being on probation as far as the Tories are concerned. David Cameron made a sort of amusing, but I felt slightly ungracious, speech of congratulations when Berko was elected. And I know that there are a lot of backbenchers very unhappy about his appointment. Basically, the Tory establishment wanted Sir George Young, former Tory cabinet minister, who contested with the runoff with Berko, but lost in the end quite convincingly by, I think, 51 votes.
Will Woodward. And there's full coverage at guardian.co.uk/politics. Also on The Guardian's website today, The Second Coming of Apple's Steve Jobs by Ed Pilkington at guardian.co.uk/technology. Justine Davis discusses why antioxidants aren't very good for you. That's at guardian.co.uk/health. And Mark Lawson says that British theatre repertoire has never been so narrow as it is now. Have your say at guardian.co.uk/culture. Police in Tehran fired weapons and tear gas at protesters yesterday who defied threats from the Iranian authorities and took to the streets of Tehran. The clashes came after the Revolutionary Guard warned demonstrators to be prepared for confrontation. Meanwhile, the authorities admitted that irregularities in the disputed presidential poll had occurred on a much wider scale than they previously said. Because of reporting restrictions, Robert Tate is following the situation for The Guardian from Istanbul.
Well, there were clashes specifically reported in Hatipir Square in central Tehran, and this has been a flashpoint for several of the days of the protests have been taking place in. Yesterday, it was very heavily policed by all accounts, and it was difficult for demonstrators to get in there and to gather in any numbers, and police were moving them on if they tried to stand still. If they tried to walk around the square and keep on the move, the officers would break them up. And basically just making sure that the vast numbers that we saw appearing in major thoroughfares and squares of Tehran and other cities last week did not reappear. In addition, there's a huge presence in other guises. For example, that witnesses were reporting that there were at least three helicopters hovering above the square overhead, and they saw a number of men on the rooftops watching over the area with binoculars. And there also reports that a nearby mosque, people could hear shouts of pain emitting from this mosque, and the suggestion being that it was people who had been picked up and arrested and were being beaten in detention inside the mosque. So all in all, not a pretty picture.
Have the protests now run out of steam?
We don't know. We're not there to report firsthand. And indeed, there are very few reporters who are left in Tehran and not allowed to go to them. I think it's not so much a matter of running out of steam as really being powerless in the face of overwhelming police and security force presence. I mean, after all, the Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei has warned explicitly of bloodshed if these demonstrations are to continue, and added furthermore that that would be in the hands of the leaders of these protests. So I think people are genuinely intimidated, and even the ones who are not intimidated, once they're going to go out and see that the situation on the ground, they are genuinely prevented from gathering in the way that they were in the first few days after the election.
And as for the election itself, Iran's Guardian Council has been making a further statement about the way it says the election was conducted.
Well, it is quite extraordinary. They have admitted that there were many irregularities, and even gone so far as to admit that there were 50 towns in which or cities as they called them, in which the turnout was greater, 100% or greater. And that's extraordinary by any manner of means, but that was announced yesterday as if they were playing down the true allegations, the original allegations, which were that this 100% or greater turnout was initially alleged to have taken place in 200 different places. Well, the Gardaí Council just dismissed that and said, well, only half in 50 places.
Robert Tait. Well, Neda Soltani was one of the demonstrators killed in clashes with Iranian security forces, and the authorities have banned a memorial service for her from taking place. Neda emerged as a symbol of the rebellion after her death was captured on YouTube. Hamid, the blogger who posted the video, spoke to The Guardian's Matthew Weaver.
At the June 20, I was online in the internet, and I was collecting information, correct information, and publishing it into my Yahoo 360 weblog, because just that one is not filtered in Iran, but Facebook, Twitter, and some others are filtered in so many places in Iran. At the same time, one of my friends in Facebook wrote to me, my wife came home and someone is killed next to her, and the clothes of my wife was bloody. I reported this one into my weblog, but as I am not sure, I was not sure, I removed it some minutes later. And I called to one of my friends in Tehran, in Amirabad, at the same location that Neda is killed, and asked him about what is going on over there. And he asked me, is it possible to you to publish a video that I took right now, some minutes before? I said, yes, absolutely. And he emailed it to me. And I was ready to send it to CNN and BBC, and as soon as possible I got it. My blood pressure went down. I was very confused. I was crying at the same time, because you have seen that movie.
Yeah.
And I published it to CNN. I sent it two times to BBC. And as I remember, and in the YouTube and to the Facebook. And 5 minutes later, it started to get several emails and messages, and it published everywhere, and it was something like that.
When you first saw the video, did you realize that this was going to be an important moment in the uprising?
Yes, because it shocked me very, very much, and I was sure at that time everyone in the world, if he or she see this movie, will be shocked. And I feel that I must broadcast it and publish it, because I try to show to the world what is going on in my country.
Hamid talking to Matthew Weaver. I'm John Dennis. Coming up in Guardian Daily, criticism of the government's efforts to secure the release of British hostages held in Iraq. And will a growing sex scandal bring down Silvio Berlusconi?
He said that he was just an old friend of Noemi's family, and this was backed up by Noemi's family.
But first, some of the most picturesque and historically important sites in England are being wrecked, according to English Heritage's annual survey of buildings at risk. It's included for the first time England's 9,300 conservation areas. And the news is dismal. The English Heritage chief executive is Simon Thurley.
Well, when most people think of protected places for their history in this country, you think of listed buildings. But actually, conservation areas cover a huge amount of the land mass of the country. There are 9,300 of them, and they're basically areas of special architectural and historical interest.
Now, this is the first time that English Heritage has included conservation areas on its annual register of historic sites at risk. What's the criteria? How do you decide whether a building or a conservation area is at risk?
Well, for the conservation areas, we're basing this on a survey we did of 75% of local authorities in England. And so, essentially, we wrote to the conservation officers in the local authorities and said to them, do you think your conservation area is getting worse, is getting better, or is it staying about the same, and what are the reasons for that? And on the basis of that information, we were able to compile the register.
And what kind of problems were councils telling you about?
Well, most of the problems are small incremental changes that, when you put them all together, begin to erode the character of the place. And so they're things like unsympathetic replacement doors and windows, UPVC windows, poorly maintained roads, pavements, satellite dishes, the effects of traffic calming, those sorts of things.
And which areas of the country were particularly badly hit?
Well, funnily enough, it was fairly evenly distributed across the country. We found that 1 in 7 conservation areas was what we describe as at risk. Turning that on its head, it does mean that 6 out of 7 are okay, which is quite good news.
And there are some quite surprising inclusions on this list. I mean, St Albans, quite a beautiful city.
I think the difficulty is with many of these places is that the changes that have taken place have almost happened imperceptibly. And so if you just take a normal residential area and you imagine that gradually over a period of 5 or 6 years, people have taken down their front walls and their hedges and fences, tarmacked over their gardens and made them places for their cars to park. If you imagine that happening over a large area, a conservation area, 1 or 2 you might not notice, but suddenly, after a lot of people have done it, you'll suddenly find that the area looks very different. All the greenery's gone, the hedges have gone, front gardens have gone, and the place starts getting a very difficult, different and slightly unsympathetic character. And that's kind of the way it happens, really. It happens in a way, it creeps up on you and it's almost unexpected.
And how has the recession affected endangered sites?
The short answer is we don't really know yet. I mean, the number of buildings at risk, which is the category that we've been monitoring for the longest time, has barely changed from last year, which seems to suggest that a lot of work has ground to a halt, that neither good things are happening nor bad things are happening. But it is quite early days, as we've only got 1 year of data.
And what would you like councils to do to improve and protect these sites?
Well, I think what we really want is we want local people, if they feel concerned about their conservation area, concerned about the place where they live, if they think there are lots of changes that are happening that they don't like and that are undermining the character of their part of town, they should get in touch with the council and ask them to impose something called an Article 4 direction, which basically means the council will require permission for certain changes to be made.
Simon Thurley from English Heritage. Silvio Berlusconi has pledged to hang tough in the face of a growing scandal over the alleged procurement of women. With the details is our correspondent in Rome, Tom Kington.
Officially, he's accused of nothing. What the current, if you like, scandal involves is a businessman in Bari who prosecutors believe was involved in corrupt business practices. They were wiretapping him, and they began to understand that he was also organizing groups of young women to attend events, parties and dinners held by politicians, businessmen, one of whom was Silvio Berlusconi. And so therefore, with the release of this news, Berlusconi has come under pressure to explain what he was doing entertaining girls at dinner at his Rome residence, girls who had apparently been paid to be there. That then developed into a more serious question when one of the guests at that one of the dinners alleged that a fellow guest had slept with Berlusconi.
And what has Berlusconi said about this?
This particular episode, Berlusconi has dismissed as rubbish, just as he fought against earlier accusations that he had frequented a teenage model, Noemi Letizia. This is back last month. He said that he was just an old friend of Noemi's family, and this was backed up by Noemi's family. It didn't, however, stop his wife, Veronica Lario, saying that she would divorce Berlusconi because she was fed up with him frequenting minors.
Now, how is this growing scandal affecting Berlusconi's grip on power?
There has been distinct unease amongst many of his allies, although an equal number of his allies have come out fiercely defending him, saying that this is all a planned campaign against him by the left wing, particularly a left wing, left leaning newspaper, La Repubblica. They say that the left has really nothing to use against Berlusconi at the moment because he's running the country efficiently, they say. And so the left is stooping to digging around into his private life, which they have no right to do, in order to score points. As Italy goes through European elections and moves towards hosting the G8, which will bring a good number of world leaders to Italy.
One opposition politician has compared Berlusconi with the Roman Emperor Nero. I mean, how's all this going down with the voters?
I believe that Italy is very polarized between those who love Berlusconi and those who despise him. It's been like that for a long time. And I think that both those sides are now becoming even more convinced of their position. And so, if you like, it just means that the divide is greater, and people will go on saying what they've always said about Berlusconi. That said, there might be a slight chipping away at Berlusconi's support. I think that was evidenced in the European elections, where the victory that he was seeking didn't come about. He lost some percentage points in the results. And so I think a bit of a chipping away, but otherwise, no. As I said, I think that you either love him or you hate him here in Italy, and that hasn't changed much.
Tom Kington. Last week, the bodies of two British hostages, Jason Cresswell from Glasgow and Jason Swindlehurst from Lancashire, were handed over to the UK embassy in Baghdad. Yesterday, the Prime Minister said the release of the remaining three Britons held hostage in Iraq, that's the IT consultant Peter Moore and two other bodyguards, identified only as Alan and Alec, was a top priority. Gordon Brown said his Iraqi counterpart, Nouri al-Maliki, has pledged to make renewed efforts to free them. The five were seized at the Iraqi finance ministry 2 years ago by a group of Shia extremists posing as police officers. They're demanding the release of a group of prisoners held by the US military in Iraq. Julian Borger, our diplomatic editor, says it's impossible to say whether the British government has done everything it can to secure the hostages' release.
The British government saying they're working 24 hours a day on this, that they've never let up, that this is their primary concern. You've had complaints from at least one of the relatives saying, we haven't heard enough, we haven't been kept in touch. Now that, the most outspoken of the relatives, Graham Moore, the father of Peter Moore, one of the remaining hostages, has been very critical of the British government. But the British government says, Foreign Office says, that he is not the nominated member of the family nominated by the hostage himself, because he was the natural father but not the adoptive parents, and that Peter Moore, the hostage in negotiations, nominated his adoptive parents, and that's why Graham Moore, the natural father, has not been kept in the loop. So there are a lot of personal issues that are involved here, but ultimately it's impossible to know. It's obviously impossible to verify that the Foreign Office has been working as hard and the British government has been working as hard as it says it has.
I mean, obviously in these situations, the government has to tread a very fine line. It's under pressure from both sides. One side telling them not to negotiate with hostage takers and other people saying that they should open a dialogue. I mean, what's been happening in this case?
There's no doubt that a dialogue has been going on. British government will never admit to that. But it seems clear that in this case, through Iraqi intermediaries, the Iraqi government intermediaries, there has been a dialogue. But the difficulty is, and the dilemma is in cases like this, whether to go public or not. And the Foreign Office's default position, pretty much, is to try and keep things quiet, because publicity can lead to unpredictable events. For example, if stuff is printed in the media and it conflicts with what the hostages have been telling the hostage takers, for example, that could be dangerous to them, they point out. There are all sorts of unforeseen consequences of going public. And so the default position of Foreign Office is try to keep things quiet, keep it out of the media, and go behind the scenes. But of course, when the story ends, as it has in this case, with two dead bodies, then it's inevitable that there are going to be questions asked over whether the strategy followed was the right one.
David Miliband's admitted that the deaths of the two men were amount to a failure of the British government not to secure their safe release. But it doesn't necessarily mean that the remaining three won't survive this, does it?
No, there's still hope for them. There's no reason to believe that they have come to harm, but the Foreign Office has expressed grave concerns about their fate. It's not a very good sign that two of the hostages have turned out dead.
Julian Borger. Guardian Daily was produced today by Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey. I'm John Dennis. Thanks for listening.